Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 9th of December 2011 here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line all the way from my home and native land of Canada by Michael Goodbaum of RockTheNation.org. So, Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Oh, yeah, no, thank you for getting the word out.
Well, as I understand it from the email correspondence that we had before this conversation, that you were involved with our previous guest, Lawrence McCurry, in some of the resolutions and things that were trying to be passed at Occupy Toronto. So why don't you tell us in your own words about your Occupy Toronto experience?
Well, sure. I became friends with Lawrence a few weeks into Occupy Toronto. I was there, you know, from day one, sleeping there without really a tent or anything, and then eventually getting a tent and staying for a couple of weeks. And I was pretty patient and forgiving with the movement from the start of it because of how, I guess, new it seemed. And I was a little bit naive going in, hoping that I could pass through a lot of different political actions, get some political support for some of the things that Rock the Vote has been talking about doing. And immediately all I was doing was going around asking people questions, trying to find out what were their reasons, their issues with the government that they wanted to have addressed at Occupy Toronto, and came up with a list. And unbeknownst to me, at the exact same time, Lawrence McCurry had the same action to come up with a list of what are the proposed changes we want, and tried to bring them to the Occupy through the traditional GA shenanigans, which is you come up, you know, you wave your hand around, you let someone put your name on a list, and then if you can convince them that your topic is relevant, they'll let you talk, and otherwise they'll all kind of shout over you. And most of the time ended up getting some level of support for these proposals, and Lawrence was getting a ton of support. But then when it comes time to actually get anything done, you have to form consensus. And that means, well, what exactly? We never know. There's a team that basically decides when consensus is formed, and they never are present in the park. They're people who, these facilitator people, didn't even really live in the park. A lot of them were just coming down there to sort of do this control thing at the GAs where they decide, okay, does this have enough support? Can we table this for discussion? Can we let the committee secretly decide on it? And what was happening is that when we were getting enough attention that people are asking, hey, yeah, why haven't we, you know, done this sort of thing, made a list, gone out to the media, done a press release? The facilitators came down and, you know, did the block. They forced the issue off the GAs. And then eventually said, well, you can keep doing this in a separate committee that will be a proposal committee. So we created the proposal committee. And then the proposal committee was given absolutely no support at all from the media team or resources or anything. They wouldn't even let us use their printer in the tent to print up, you know, this list of documents and take it around and do a proper petition with it. And so we started taking it to Facebook, taking it to the live stream, and that's when censorship was encountered widely by anyone who was trying to have either these proposals be talked about or the criticism of, like, why haven't we issued a press release? Why haven't we gone in behind on everything and done everything with press releases, let everyone know what we're doing? So I was banned from the live stream, which is their 24-hour Occupy news. I'd gone on there and basically asked, you know, has anyone discussed this? Why not? And then was told, you know, don't ask questions about this. If you do it again, you're going to be banned. And so I kept getting banned over and over again. And then one night, you know, I was banned like three times. So I decided I'd had enough. I had in my possession a megaphone that I'd rented for the purposes of some marches and stuff. So I went down to the park with the megaphone, and, you know, this is the megaphone we'd earlier used to read the proposed list of changes out there. And I told them that I'd been censored from the live stream, and why was there so much censorship within a movement that's supposed to be about free speech, that's supposed to be about protesting media control, as well as, you know, a monetary system. And what happened there was just scary. A bunch of people got up on the stage and surrounded me. And one of them grabbed the megaphone out of my hands, and another one started kind of hitting me on the arms like they were just going to grab it away from me. So I'm a pretty loud guy anyways. I shouted without the megaphone and, you know, caused a real hubbub in the park, which got the attention of one of these, wasn't actually a facilitator, but one of these head organizer people, who's someone who admittedly, you know, personally between him and me, and then this was confirmed by others, went to New York and trained with Otpor on how to be a revolutionary, peaceful revolutionary. He came over and he used some, you know, mediation techniques to kind of calm me down. And he said, you know, this person here needs our respect, and, you know, they're a really key member of the occupation, and the work they're doing is so important. He got me on the live stream for, you know, 2 minutes to sort of throw me a bone, like, why don't you, now that you're banned from the live stream, why don't you go on there? And we talked about censorship, and then those comments were deleted, and the next day, or maybe the day after, I was permanently banned from commenting on the live stream, and my girlfriend as well. When I was banned, she asked, you know, why was I banned, and is free speech factoring into this decision at all? And the discussion we had with the guy who's the mod on there, who's not someone I met, they were not living at the park, but they were, you know, in charge of deciding who was a troll on the web live stream, said that in his discussions with this organizer who I told you about, you know, the one trained by Otpor, this media guy, that they didn't really care about that issue, free speech, at all, and that they had no problem with the number of people who were being banned, who at that point was, you know, hundreds of people who had been banned. Every single one of my friends in the end from Occupy, who's on our, you know, like Getting It Done committee, got banned at least once or twice from the live stream or the Facebook. So that's not surprising.
Not surprising in the least, but let's just stop for a moment. And for people out there who don't know what Otpor is or what that connection might mean, can you explain a little bit about that group?
Okay, yeah, sure. Otpor was a group that came out of the Serbian Revolution that it was later revealed was a, let's just say, started by American intelligence kind of group. They're a private, not-for-profit, that teaches people around the world revolutionary tactics, and they go by a book from Gene Sharp called From Dictatorship to Democracy. It's basically their Bible for revolutionary nonviolence. And some of the things that they do are, you know, they've got a logo with a fist at all of their rallies that's now happened all around the world, whether it was in the Arab Revolution or, you know, coming after that, they all have the fist as their logo. And they have certain techniques that have now been taken kind of without really too much thought to it at the beginning by the Occupy movement, and used all of these GAs to do crowd control, like mic check, repeating after leader techniques, and some of the language, like this is a leaderless movement. That's from Otpor. That's from their book. You know, they say this is a leaderless movement. And I would not be surprised if some of the slogans, like we're the 99%, you know, peaceful protest. These things are coming out of Harvard University. Gene Sharp, who wrote this book from Otpor, is Harvard University trained economist. They're not, you know, exactly. Now, Gene Sharp obviously did serve time, actually, for being an activist and a protester, I think, back in the 60s. But they're not what you'd call your typical grassroots. Okay, protesters, these are people who use techniques that, for lack of a better word, resemble brainwashing. This sort of way of saying you can't, any kind of criticism of what they're doing with the revolution, they say, no, that's an attack. You have to be positive. So if you go there and you criticize anything, you know, like, hey, why are we supporting Robin Hood tax? When did we vote for it? They'll say, you know, your concern is valid. You know, I respect your participation, sir, but how can you be positive moving forward? So you keep getting these same phrases from all of the facilitation team, all of the people who are, you know, like closest to them and really most set on the movement working out well. They keep repeating the same crap over and over again. So no matter what the problem is, like, you know, hey, who's in charge of the accounting for the money? What happened to all the thousands of dollars that were donated? no matter how critical it is that we know about it, they say, well, how can you think of a positive way of moving this forward? You know, how can we do this in a, you know, this is too negative. You're being overbearing. So there's the video that Lawrence recently posted. It's him and a bunch of us confronted the facilitators at their meeting in a pub and went in to ask them, where's the money gone? Who's in charge of it? And all of these kind of hard questions that they didn't want to answer. And you hear them stumbling through all of their different things that they say, like, well, you know, you're trying to hijack the movement, and all this stuff that they know is just to deflect, you know, to shoot the messenger, not the message. And the message at this point is like, my gosh, the level of corruption within it, the level of confusion, whether it's deliberate or not, over what's been done with the money, who's actually in charge of it, and everything is crazy. And we just want to ask, you know, simple questions about this stuff. Nothing critical. You have to sit down and all talk about what is your positive feeling for this week, and, you know, like, what's the one thing that you're so happy about in your life, and share all this crap before you can get down to the actual series nuts and bolts of who did what with the money. And I think a really telling part of that is that one of the people who we've accused of spoiling the funds, they were doing a squat after the occupation was shut down by the police. They took over squatting in a building and barricaded and stuff and tried to, you know, start off doing it that way. That person, when we asked where he got in the permission to use the funds for that, not only disappeared from the meeting, just disappeared without saying anything, but first tried to get the bartender to kick us out of the pub for being unruly at this meeting. And then, you know, really, we even got him on camera saying, we asked who paid for some of these people traveling to New York to meet with OPPOR and be trained by them. He said, the unions. You know, we've really got all the evidence to show that there's too much corruption to really trust the people who are speaking on behalf of a movement that's to stop corruption. I mean, it's crazy. Unions are paying for everything, and they don't need to ever announce who's actually in charge of the money. Then, for all intents and purposes, the unions run Occupy. The labor movement runs it.
So just to clarify, it was confirmed by the organizers themselves that this person had been trained by OPPOR?
Sure, on camera. You can go to my website that has that video right now is rocktheoccupation.com, and it's there under the footage section. And we've got a couple of people videoed it. Yeah, they repeat that audio clip a few times for you to hear it, just so you make sure. He asks, you know, who paid for the members who traveled to New York to train with OPPOR? And they say, the unions paid for that. And this is from the person who is the head, one of the heads of one of the teams. I don't want to incriminate them, but it would be hard to, because they go by aliases anyways. You know, that was in the Toronto Star. He had gone by an alias without telling the newspaper this, in violation of their whole the trust that was given to that journalist. He's been using different aliases, and that's not the only person who's done that. So it's like, how are you tracking these people? First off, they won't even give the names of the people who are signatories on the account for Occupy Toronto. That they just say it's held in checks, and so you ask, okay, well, who's overseeing that? And they say, we can't tell you because you might use it to ruin their reputations. Never mind that, like, anyone should be able to ask this, but, you know, if you have to respond to criticism by saying something other than, we have to be secret because you're making us secret because you're too critical.
Well, I think that's pretty self-evident. So what's your take on the percentage of people in the Occupy Toronto movement who are aware and concerned about these issues, and the percentage that are just blindly backing up whatever the organizers are doing and saying?
I think the easiest way to see the percentage is to look at how many people have dropped out of the movement that were there at the beginning. On day one, there were like in excess of 5,000 people marching, and there were about 500 people in the park. And as the weeks went by, I left it, I think, week three or something. I couldn't take it anymore. The fact that the whole process just seemed so deliberately slowed down and neutered or whatever. But more and more people kept leaving until the last week there was like no one there. There's been, we watched, they still have GAs and they have them outside City Hall. So we just watched their live stream and there were maybe a dozen people there. And there's just as many people in some of the other side movements that have come out of it. There's other people claiming, you know, status and why not, saying they're doing Occupy Toronto as well. And they've been building up followings themselves that are, you know, not necessarily all branched off from it. Maybe they're recruiting some new people or their own political ideas are appealing to new people. But a large number of people who were supporting the movement have stopped wholesale. And the criticism, the web presence has switched considerably because luckily there's still screen caps of everything that's been said. They delete the posts from Facebook, but then we put screen caps. So it's permanent record of everything. We've got videos of the live stream when we were banned and stuff. You know, there's a record of all this censorship. And so as more people see and ask, well, why should they have to censor anyone in a protest? If it's all about representing what the people want, if it's all organic and spontaneous, why should they have this directive that they need to follow? No one can say this and no one can say this. No one can write Alex Jones on any of the pages. You get banned for writing Alex Jones, you know.
Well, what an evil, dirty word that is, certainly. But so the occupation was evicted last month, was that right?
It was November 6th. It was, yeah, so about a month ago now.
And since that point, it's basically dwindled to the point where it's about a dozen people coming to general assemblies now.
Well, they had quite a little after party first in the Sheraton Hotel where the Ontario Federation of Labour paid for them to have a hall rented out, you know, for doing media, the live stream on their computers, because, of course, you need an entire hotel room and a hall for that. And I've got a post that's from a official online media representative of Occupy Toronto. And you know, they said, quote, they showered us with gifts from alcohol to candy. And, you know, talking about meeting the president of the labor union, getting his personal phone number, which they're not sharing with us. They to say that they just dwindled is almost downplaying how big of a debacle it's been, that they went from being, you know, criticized in the park to now they won't let anyone come in to their little private thing. If you try and go to one of these meetings, then they will stop the meeting and say, why are you here? If you're going to be critical, you can't stay. To that extent, they had a hotel room, of course. People wanted to come and see what was up, and they didn't allow them in because they were the media team. You know, it's, if you're not on the team, and even if you are on the team, well, then tough luck. So Democrat, you know, such a people's movement, right?
Indeed.
We have three people on security in their room. The job is to keep people out.
Interesting. So what's your take on where this is likely to be heading at this point? Or do you think the momentum has completely been sucked out of this movement now?
No, you know, to be honest, I think something completely is coming out of it, that whether it was a natural result of the movement or not, it's networking people who of all ages, okay, of all occupations, within this are now meeting we've got our meetings to discuss what to do about Occupy. And I don't think anything's going to come out of it short term. It looks like short term Occupy is pretty much dead, or whatever's planned is going to happen. But no one's really planning anything right now that I know of. They're talking about taking over schools and stuff. But in the spring, there will, I mean, if we're still talking about it, then there will be at least new people doing new movements, I hope. Now, I don't know what percentage of the occupies all around the world are controlled like they are in Toronto, to the extent that they are here and in New York and in maybe D.C. and places like that. The really important occupies, I think, have had whatever number, whatever percentage of people coming in and deciding what will the marches really be about and what will get through GA and stuff. But I hope that, you know, like there's going to be an Occupy Scarborough, one of the suburbs outside Toronto. There's going to be tinier movements branching off this. And even the possibility of however many people are pissed off at Occupy itself, of doing a group that tries something completely different. Because part of the problem right now is the process was decided, by Harvard sociologists and political scientists through OPOR. We're doing the same thing that they're doing all around the world. If people realize that these revolutions are kind of like colored revolutions, then there might be a true resistance coming out of it to see how can we do something completely different from what every other protest has been doing, which has clearly not been effective.
It's the old definition of insanity, trying the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And I think, if there is anything hopeful that's emerging from this, it's that, as I've said all along, these things are people's movements. And even if they are, being directed by things like OPOR, at least the people still have a chance to really change that direction and to insert their own views into it and to attempt to at least expose what's going on, like you have been doing. So would you direct people to rocktheoccupation.com?
Yeah, that site's got a lot of the best videos on it right now, and it links to the other site, Rock Nation, Rock the Vote, and that stuff is on there too.
Very interesting. All right, Michael Goodbaum, thank you so much for your time today, and I look forward to hearing perhaps an update in the future about what's happening in Toronto.
Oh, absolutely. I look forward to listening to your show.